Chapter 32. Jason seized a rock outcropping and held it, keeping him from dropping once more toward the man with the face of Luke Skywalker.
"You're just about as good as my true master," Jason said.
And it was true. The phantom he fought had the speed and moves of a Jedi master. He'd be a fair match for Luke. The bearded man gave him a mocking look.
"And who is that?"
"You know," Jason said. "By the way, you look good with a beard."
"You think so?"
His opponent stroked his facial hair.
"Well, I'm not sure what our disagreement is, but perhaps it could be settled by talking."
Jason considered that.
This combat was not just pointless, being carried out at someone else's wish for someone else's ends, but also dangerous. The false Luke was potentially good enough to kill Jason.
Still, the false Luke reeked of the dark side of the Force. There could be no enduring benefit in cooperating with him. Could there? For a moment, Jason was confused, weighing the preponderance of Jedi history and claims about Darksiders against his own limited experience. But he decided in favor of history and tradition.
"I try not to negotiate with phantoms, with things that don't exist. Better to just cut them in half and watch them disappear."
Jason kicked off from the wall and flew forward again. He knew that this solidly planted, gravitationally advantaged Luke had adapted to Jason's low-gravity tactics, so he altered them. The instant he touched down before the false Luke, he planted his feet and used the Force to brace him there, then threw a flurry of hard blows. It was no use. The false Luke adapted instantly to his change in tactics, reverting to a softer, defensive style, turning away each of Jason's all-out attacks. And he did so grinning, silently mocking. The false Luke, instead of countering Jason's fifth blow in sequence, sidestepped it, luring Jason forward and off balance. Luke's counter-strike whipped around and down toward Jason's unprotected back.
"Enough!"
Brescia said, and the false Luke vanished. Jason, straightening, still felt a tremor of pain from the area where the blow would have landed, and looked down to see a portion of his robe, a long black mark, on fire. He patted it out and looked up at Brescia.
"Who was that, really?"
She shrugged.
"A combination of the real Luke Skywalker and the dark side energy of this place. A combination that would have beaten you, since you weren't utilizing the same energy, the resources available to you."
She still held on to one of the rails. Sagged against it, actually. She was perspiring.
"You've been using a lot of energy yourself," Jason said.
He switched his lightsaber off. She nodded.
"Coordinating the actions of several Force phantoms at once? Very tiring. Try it sometime."
"So you admit that you're behind this assault on me?"
"Oh, it was no assault. Just a test. If it had been an assault, I would have let the Luke Phantom kill you. Don't you think?"
Jason frowned. Her words had the ring of truth to them.
"I think it's time for you to tell me your whole story."
"Of course."
She pushed off from the rail and floated toward the stone outcropping where the false Luke had originally arrived. She bounced lightly past Jason and beckoned for him to follow.
"All the answers are this way."
He followed. Relidir, Trollis. Han grinned as he completed his circuit around the shield-protected Center for the Performing Arts. His spotter droids were raining down on the ground, sustaining but ignoring small arms fire from GA ground crews and infantry, and already his board was lighting up with the data the droids were feeding to the Corellian Operations HQ.
On the wireframe representation of the local area, the top of the shield was a hotspot where numerous droids had their laser-sighting rifles trained. Above, many of the starfighters trapped within the outer range of shields were also being targeted. Hans and Wedge's shrieks were on the spotter droid's matrix as well, as non-targets. Missiles that detected and turned toward the shrieks were supposed to move away to find new targets. Missiles that came in too fast to divert their flight paths were supposed to detonate prematurely. In theory, the shrieks were safe from the missile barrage. In theory. Han didn't rely much on theory. He'd prefer to have some buildings between him and the incoming missiles. There was something wrong. Ahead, as he completed his circuit, was an Aleph where no Aleph should be. This one was battle-scarred, its fuselage scraped, its forward viewports scratched and dented. Han's eyebrows shot up. This had to be the Aleph that had pursued them on the approach boulevard. See Al Antilles' craft. Inexplicably, it had managed to follow them in. And now it was slowing, turning toward the Turkery building. Alarm bells went off in Han's head. If he were in Sial's position, he would know that missiles were roaring up behind. He would be figuring out how to stop them before they got here. And that meant dropping a rack full of missiles into the Turkery building, collapsing it so the missiles would hit the falling debris, never making it past the outer shield zone. That's what Sial was doing. And he had to stop her. He switched his weapons board over to missile fire and dropped his targeting brackets over the Aleph. And hesitated. This was Wedge's little girl. He couldn't kill her. If he didn't, the mission would be a failure, and the GA wouldn't leave, and war might break out. He heard a howling and realized, as if his mind were functioning at a distance, that it was no cockpit alarm, but his own voice, an inarticulate roar of anger and frustration filling his ears. There was no time to find the perfect solution. His thumb settled on the firing button. No perfect solution, but the fraction of a second's delay let him find a possible answer. He pushed the weapons control forward. The targeting brackets clicked off the Aleph and dropped to the ground several meters beneath the hovering starfighter. The brackets skittered around, trying to identify anything on the ground that might constitute a target. Han fired. His concussion missile flashed forward to hit the Durakrete beneath the Aleph. Sial watched impassively as Webb targeted the building just above the huge hole in the ground that the Aleph and the two bombers had emerged through. He seemed to be moving in slow motion. Everything seemed to be in slow motion. The astromech beeped an alarm, a targeting lock on the Aleph. Sial frowned. She kept her hands steady on the controls. A sideways jerk might cause Zweb to miss his target, and she couldn't afford for that to happen. Besides, the incoming fire was probably a laser barrage by an opportunistic X-wing pilot, and she could survive a few seconds of that. The world exploded around her. The Aleph was kicked as if by a rancor the size of a skyscraper. She felt her backbone compress, like one of the Aleph's vent-based upward jumps, but worse, like ejecting from a doomed starfighter, but worse. Redness filled her vision, and she clearly saw the control yoke of her starfighter. Her hand was not on it. She tried to reach for it, but couldn't seem to make her body move. Outside the viewports, banks of buildings spun, sometimes above, sometimes below, intermixed with enemy starfighters, and the sky, and the ground. The Aleph disappeared in the dust and debris cloud of Han's concussion missile, and for a moment Han thought the starfighter had gone to confetti from the force of the blast. But the Aleph leapt up out of the cloud, spinning, out of control, on a ballistic arc that would carry it within seconds back to the ground and its final destruction. Han's curved flight path carried him past the dust cloud. His shriek and Wedge's crossed each other, heading in opposite directions. He could hear Wedge's voice, chiding, "Han, you missed!" The words weren't making sense, He ignored them. All his attention was on the tumbling Aleph.
"Fly, blast it, fly," he told it, reaching out for it and its pilot as though he had force powers,
as if he could help Sial. He couldn't, of course. He watched the doomed Aleph reach the top of its arc and begin descending toward the ground. Its tumbling roll, was it changing? As it spun, did it seem to linger for a moment with its nose pointed to the sky?
On its next spin, he was sure.
The pilot was attempting to regain control. The thrusters, as they began to be pointed toward the ground, fired, and continued firing until they were horizontal. They cut off again, but the spinning was slowed, and the next time the thrusters oriented downward, they fired again and held, propelling the Aleph upward. The explosion-blackened starfighter wobbled as it resumed powered flight, but it was under control. And turning back toward the Turkery building, its mission not yet accomplished. Han stared in disbelief. Was he going to have to blow her up again?
No.
A cloud of what looked like flaming insects roiled up from the crater at the foot of the Turkery building. Missiles, in their hundreds. Most headed skyward. Their flight plan would have them turn just under the dome of the outer shield and dive toward the inner, hitting two or three spots, overwhelming them with explosive power, allowing the subsequent missiles to rain down on the Center for the Performing Arts. Others would target the starfighters overhead, and the larger ships still on the ground. Han saw two turn toward the Aleph. The Aleph, in response, banked straight toward Han's Shriek, flying underneath and past it. As soon as the Aleph and Shriek were so close to each other that their signals would be mixed on the missile sensors, the missiles turned away, hunting new targets. The Aleph dropped to ground level and skidded to a stop among several parked speeders, making it an unlikely target for continued missile targeting. Han grinned. The girl was in good enough shape to try to kill him again. Her tactic, leading pursuit missiles across his path, would have worked had he not already been designated a non-target by the droids. All was right with the world. He could have cheered. At least all was right until his data pad beeped again at him. Its screen read, "Transponder Trago F1103 on frequency 22NF07 is Jaina." The majority of missiles reached the summit of their arcs and turned back toward the ground. Some didn't. A few hit targets in the air, starfighters circling above the Galactic Alliance beachhead, pilots waiting to get into the fight, pilots who weren't fast enough to elude missile fire or eject in anticipation of the impact. The other missiles completed their turns and roared downward, concentrating into three streams. The leading missiles of those streams hit the glowing dome of the GA shield, matching their explosive energy against its coherent force. The first several lost that match. The shields were too strong. But the missiles kept coming, each one adding new explosive power to the equation. The shields shivered. Complicated energy matrices began to lose their coherence. Within the Center for the Performing Arts, alert, failure, and overload lights began to flare on shield generator machinery. Operators began to look at one another uncertainly, and the more fearful of them glanced around for a place to take shelter, for a direction to run. Then, in 1/1000th of a second, it happened. The complex fabric of the shield unraveled at one point, and the next missile entered the empty space where it had been. It did not detonate. The computer at the heart of its guidance system relayed its new position, meters beyond what had been designated the shield limits, to the other missiles in the flight, and those that could still maneuver to position themselves along its path began to do so. That missile was halfway down to the crown-like top of the Center for the Performing Arts when the next spot atop the curved surface of the shield gave way. More missiles flashed through the widening gap. The foremost missiles roared down toward the roof below. calculating at each minute fraction of a second their current position, estimated range to target, estimated fuel reserves. Observers weren't aware of what happened in thousandths of a second, of course. When the first missiles struck the shield, onlookers saw a glow begin there, accompanying the distant whoomph of the missile's detonation. The glow grew larger and brighter. The noise from the detonations became louder. Then a lance of fire shot down from the position of the shields and hit the roof of the Center for the Performing Arts. The center seemed to swell, its walls bulging outward with flame behind them. Then the whole immense building erupted like a cake of solid fuel. Ironically, though the shield projectors were in the act of melting, disintegrating, the shields they created had not had enough time to fail utterly, and the leading edges of the explosion hit them, were contained by them. Then the shields gave way, and the flame and debris behind them spilled out in all directions. Missiles continued to rain down, many of them pouring into the increasingly cavernous hole that the center had been. Others hurtled onto the hulls of the small capital ships that had landed around the center. Their shields were up. Their shields went down, collapsing under the relentless explosive barrage. And those fighting ships began erupting with explosions of their own. Coruscant. I was fighting a simulacrum of Jason, Luke said. He paced through his bedchamber, looking in the closet and then under the bed, as if more enemies were likely to be found there.
Mine was a twisted form of Ben, Mara said. Rather cruel of an enemy to try to kill you in the image of your own son.
Luke, on his knees by the bed, looked up at her. Why didn't they send a Ben against each of us? Wouldn't that improve the odds that one of us would hesitate, at least in theory? Mara shrugged.
What did this?
Luke rose. A dark side force user of some sort, or a group of them. Something new? I don't know. He moved back to the closet and pulled out his off-white pants and tunic. Something's happening out there, where Leia is, maybe where Jason and Ben are. I'm going to get on the comm and see what I can find out.
Give me my robe. I'll join you.
Mara tried to push aside her sense of unease. It had gripped her the moment she'd kicked the mutated image of her son. And it hadn't left her. Star System MZX-32905, near Bimiel. Around the rock outcropping, Jason came face to face with another rock, a boulder of black stone, its surface shiny and smooth. It was unlike any other surface he'd seen while in these caverns, and it reeked of dark side energy. A door, he said. Beside him, Brescia nodded. Jason reached out to explore the barrier with his force-attuned senses. The stone seemed to be resting on a pivot of pure energy. The slightest exertion would swing it to one side. But the exertion had to be made through the force, through the dark side of the force. Perhaps a light side exertion would swing it open as well, but he sensed that such an exertion would have to be much greater. He shrugged, gestured, exerted himself minimally along dark paths. The boulder swung obediently to one side. There was darkness beyond. Brescia moved into the darkness, and Jason followed her. Just past the boulder entrance, on the similarly smooth stone to the left, a set of sturdy metal levers and controls was revealed, and she flipped several of those switches from the bottom to the top position. In the distance, a light came on, bright golden light, cheerful and warm in hue, revealing that Jason and Brescia stood in an irregular stone corridor, triangular, wide at the base, coming to a point a couple of meters above their heads. The corridor widened a few meters before them, and the cavern beyond was being illuminated by the new light. Gravity, too, was asserting itself. Jason's second step was half the floating, bouncing distance of the first, and the next was almost correct for Coruscant standard gravity. After that, he felt that he could have been on Coruscant, except for the coldness of the air.
"The heaters are now on,"
Brescia said, as though reading his mind.
"But it takes a while to warm a space as large as this."
"Of course," Jason said. They moved out from the corridor and into the open cavern, and Jason blinked at what he saw. The cavern was open, its walls slightly irregular, but still of the same dark, smooth material as the boulder door. The cavern ceiling was perhaps 50 meters up at its lowest point, 60 at its highest, and the space was longer than it was high, some 200 meters in length in one dimension, 150 in another. But none of that registered at first. Jason's eye was drawn to the building that occupied the cavern's center. It was a mansion, 5 stories of stony construction, and it did not seem in the least ominous. The building's outer surfaces were rock, but dressed white and green marble slabs rather than the ponderous dark stone of this asteroid. Its windows were wide, unshuttered, inviting. At each corner of the building was a tower, the chamber at its summit roofed but open to the sides, and figures moved there and in various windows of the building. In one tower window, a figure painted. In another, one played an oversized harp, and distant notes, soft and true, reached Jason's ears. In one of the lower windows, a figure juggled 3 glowing yellow balls. At the center of the 5th floor, a huge mechanism, all gigantic gears and levers, operated, its whole purpose apparently being to drive a single dial on the face of the building. It turned at a rate of 2 or 3 times a minute, carefully watched by a figure who stood on the 5th floor ledge in front of it. The moving figures were all protocol droids, and gaily painted, one red, one forest green, one gold. The machine tender was a pastel blue, and it was all suffused with dark side energy.
"This," Jason said, "is insane."
"Not really."
Brescia walked toward the building with him.
"Darth Vectivus enjoyed the architecture of Naboo and incorporated some of its building materials into his home away from home. Other architectural elements are from other worlds."
"But it's not very Sithly. The Sith Citadel at Zeos—"
"I've been there. Very gloomy place. Unnecessarily so."
They reached the steps up to the main doors, and as they began climbing, those doors swung open for them. Beyond was a marble-lined hallway. Waist-high columns along its walls supported busts of men and women, mostly human, some of other species.
"All right," Jason said, "no more delays. The truth."
He reached the top of the stairs and moved into the hallway. He felt a little off balance. The dissonance between the energies he felt and the cheerful surroundings bothered him.
"The truth is, I trained to be a Sith. I was trained by your grandfather, Darth Vader."
She did not seem in the least ashamed by this revelation. Jason drew to a stop at the first of the busts. It showed a serene-looking woman, her hair in a layered style that reached high.
"But you don't talk like a galaxy-conquering psychopath."
"Vader wasn't a galaxy-conquering psychopath. He was a sad man, whose one love in life had died, and whose one anchor to the world of the living was, yes, a galaxy-conquering madman, Palpatine. The bust, by the way, is of Vectivus's mother. She wasn't Sith. She wasn't Jedi."
Jason shot Brescia an irritable look and gestured for her to keep going.
"All right. My true name is Shira Bree."
Jason blinked at her.
"But you're better known as Lumia."
In his mind, he called up holographic images he'd been shown of the famous monster. the woman whose lower face was always concealed behind a tight-fitting veil, who always wore a triangular headdress, who carried a unique weapon, a light whip, as destructive as a lightsaber, but pliant and with a greater reach. There was no place for this woman to carry one in the jumpsuit she now wore, but he did not deceive himself that she was unarmed.
Yes.
Under which name you tried to kill several members of my family.
Decades ago. Yes.
Now she did look abashed, regretful.
Don't judge me too soon, Jason. My history is very much like your Aunt Mara's, except she received some lucky breaks I didn't. I took longer to straighten out my life.
Tell me about it.
I was raised on Coruscant, tapped for Imperial service, and when Luke Skywalker became a hero of the Rebels, I joined them.
To kill him?
No, to do worse, to discredit him. A ruined hero is much more devastating than a dead one.
Her gaze slid off to one side, and Jason sensed that she was reliving events that had transpired before he was born.
I actually developed quite an attachment for your uncle. Once he was ruined as a rebel, I planned to draw him over to the Imperial side. But during a starfighter battle, he relied on the Force instead of transponder data to differentiate friend from foe, and shot me down.
I'd heard that.
I lived, but it cost me. Cost me more than half of my body, in fact. My limbs, some of my organs.
She looked down at herself.
Cybernetic replacements.
When Jason didn't answer, she continued,
And that's when Darth Vader took special interest in me. Perhaps because of our similarities. He could feel the Force potential in me, and it didn't take a master psychologist to pick up on my desire for revenge.
Which you did attempt.
Again and again, after my Sith training on Zeost. Yes.
You seem singularly unapologetic.
I don't have anything to apologize to you for. Bring me into the presence of Luke Skywalker, or Leia Organa, and, well, things will be different. Would you like to see the rest of the house?
Is there anything to it but bright, cheerful colors, bedrooms, refreshers, and so on?
Not anymore. There were lots of artifacts in his library, but I removed them to the library you saw in the habitat. There are all the gaily painted protocol droids.
Jason shuddered.
So far, the one irrefutable sign that Vectivus was evil. No, we can do the house tour after your explanation. After I retrieve Ben and Nelani. So, Palpatine and Vader both die. And you have no chance to be educated enough to become the mistress of the Sith.
Oh, there you're wrong, Jason.
Lumia shook her head as if chiding him for his ignorance.
I never had any chance to become mistress of the Sith, no matter how much I learned.
Jason moved to the next bust in line. This was a Bothan face, alert and intelligent.
Why not?
The Force is the energy of the living. You interact with it, its eddies and flows, with your own living body. It's all right to have a mechanical part or two, an implant, a replacement foot, but for true mastery in the Force, light side or dark side, you have to be mostly organic. I'm not, and so the greatest, the most significant powers I can never learn.
Jason frowned.
Wait. That means that Darth Vader could never have become the Lord of the Sith, a true master.
That's correct. I'm not sure he ever understood that. He might not have cared. He was numbed by tragedy. The Bothan you're looking at, by the way, was an old family friend of Darth Vectivus. taught Vectivus basic principles of negotiation.
Are you saying that none of these busts is a Sith?
That's right. This isn't a museum for Sith matters. It's a celebration of Vectivus's youth and life. His life, Jason. His joys and triumphs.
Jason propped his elbow up on the boffin's head.
So that's what the trap is.
Huh?
Lumia looked surprised.
You didn't lure me here to kill me. You lured me here to persuade me to take up the path of the Sith.
Yes.
Because I have all my body parts.
She grinned at him.
Not exactly. Because it's you. All the portents, all the convergences flowing into the future say so, particularly since you've already received quite a lot of Sith training.
Explain that.
In a minute. What was I saying? Oh, yes. I'm not trying to turn you into a Palpatine. He was, as you say, a psychopath. Destructive, uncaring, manipulative. He chose the dark side to achieve his ends, but was weak and confused enough to be twisted by the dark side. Unlike your Uncle Luke, you haven't been twisted by the light side. So I'm certain you can resist the temptations of the dark.
I've heard enough. The voice was Nelani's, and there she was, striding in through the front doors, her unlit lightsaber in her hand.
As I'm sure you have, Jason.
Where's Ben? Jason asked. Nelani shook her head.
We were separated. You were never together,
Lumia said.
When you were talking to Ben, and he to you, you were actually hundreds of meters apart, talking to Force phantoms of each other. A trivial thing to arrange in this place, where there's so much energy to manipulate.
She returned her attention to Jason.
Energy you could use in the name of improving people's lives, if you chose to.
Quiet!
Nelani said. Jason turned to Lumia.
Where's Ben? He repeated.
Unconscious, not hurt. He'll wake up a little sore.
Lumia shrugged.
If I were the monster you thought I was, he'd be dead, Jason. The son of the man who shot me down and destroyed my body. Think about it.
Think about this, Jason said. Brisha, Shira, Lumia, whatever you choose to call yourself, there are still outstanding charges against you for crimes committed back when you were an Imperial. Whatever you are now. You have to face those.
Perhaps.
Lumia suddenly looked tired, dispirited.
I just wish you weren't taking me into custody from your own fear. That's sad.
Fear?
Jason frowned at her. I have nothing to fear.
You're afraid that my words might be true,
Lumia said.
That the dark side doesn't corrupt in and of itself, that you're destined to become the next Sith Lord, the first Sith Lord to be active in decades, the first one in centuries with the strength to use the Sith techniques to help others. Because if it is true, you have to make a decision, choosing between your life as it is, comfortable but almost purposeless, and life as you know it should be.
Nelani's lightsabers snap-hissed into life.
I think you need to shut up,
she said.
There's no need for that,
Jason said. There was a sting to Lumia's words. The jibe about his life being purposeless was too close to the mark to be entirely ignored. Luke would have said that obedience to the guidance of the Force would give him direction and purpose. But since the end of the Yuuzhan Vong War, except for those times when he faced foes whose behavior lit up the Force like a kill-me-soon sign, the life of the Jedi hadn't given him the sense of purpose it seemed to have provided his uncle.
No need unless she resists.
Lumia smiled. There's no worry. Nelani would never attack me unless I resisted. She's a very good girl, a sweet doctrinal Jedi.
This sweet doctrinal Jedi is about to kick your teeth in, Nelani said. Jason, I can feel you wavering.
I'm not wavering. I'm just curious about her arguments. There is merit to some of them.
Like any Darksider, she mixes truth with lies until you can't separate them.
Jason ignored her. He waved at the busts and walls around him.
Lumia, you present me this house as though it constitutes proof that Darth Vectivus was a nice man despite his dark side training. Well, that doesn't wash. Anyone can commission the building of a pretty house. Palpatine was a patron of the arts. As for Vectivus himself, you not only can't prove that he was uncorrupted, you haven't offered any proof that he actually existed.
He fixed her with a look he intended as amused condescension.
The dark side corrupts. The Sith are inevitably drawn to evil.
I can give you proof of one who wasn't,
Lumia said. Nelani glared at Jason.
Don't listen.
Jason shrugged.
Go ahead.
Lumia looked dispirited.
Should I? Why bother? With sweet Nelani whispering in your ear, you're certain to automatically disbelieve every word I say.
Then the forlorn look left her face, replaced by a slight smile.
After all, everything I tell you is a lie.
Jason stared at Lumia, but she did not continue. Nelani looked between them, confused, sensing that something had changed in the conversation, something she had missed. Jason cleared his throat.
An interesting turn of phrase, he said.
Not an accidental one.
Lumia turned to look at Nelani.
Turn that thing off, dear. You'll run the battery down.
Nelani didn't budge. Her blade remained lit and glowing.
Jason, something's wrong. What is she saying?
She's saying nothing.
Then I'll give you a name,
Lumia said.
Vergere. She said that, didn't she, when she was training you to be a Sith?
She was training me to survive, Jason said.
He thought of his one-time mentor, the diminutive bird-like alien who'd been born in this galaxy, but had lived for years among the Yuuzhan Vong, accompanying them back when they swept into the galaxy on their mission of conquest and destruction.
Yes,
Lumia said.
To survive. Survival is a Sith trait. Jedi train themselves for self-sacrifice, for union with the Force, and they can afford to be suicidal because there are so many of them. Sith train to survive.
Now you're making things up, Jason said. Nelani, keep her here while I go find Ben.
Lumia shook her head.
You don't want Ben to be here. Someone's about to die. It might be you. It might be Nelani. And it might be me. Bring Ben here, and it might be him. Death is here among us, and it will be a very distressing one.
Frowning, Jason cast out his senses like a net, sampling the present and the future. Pathways led in all directions, but in each of them, one of the three people present fell dying. Jason, head severed by a pliant whip of light. Lumia, Nelani's lightsaber cutting her in half. Lengthwise, so there was no chance of missing the organic parts. Nelani, her heart speared by Jason's lightsaber. Jason, stabbed from behind by Ben, the boy's uncomprehending features making it clear that he was seeing something very different from the reality before him. Lumia, swept into a marble wall by Jason's control of the Force, her skull shattered. Jason shut his eyes against the parade of tragedy. He opened them to view reality.
You're right. I can't see a path that doesn't lead to death. Let's revise our circumstances and see if any more options open to us in a minute or two.
Good, Lumia said. Now, Vergere, a Jedi, but one who was quietly resentful of the hidebound ways of the old Jedi Council, its resistance to any learning outside the rote procedures that had been part of the Order for so long. She was a rogue student of the Force, of techniques and pathways that are not all part of the Jedi school. You agree?
Jason nodded.
In her investigations, she studies Count Dooku, and his trail leads her to Darth Sidious, who has just taken Dooku as apprentice. Darth Sidious, who, the galaxy learns decades later, is Palpatine. Sidious accepts her as a student and candidate. There can be only two Sith at any time, the Master and the Apprentice, but there can be many candidates, and she is one.
Proof, Jason said.
You'll find the proof in your feelings.
Lumia spared a look for Nalani.
Assuming the good Jedi girl doesn't kill me for saying things she doesn't like.
She won't, Jason said.
Vergere learns from Palpatine, and she learns about him. She observes. She sees his weakness, his greed, his compulsion to rule and manipulate. She realizes that he could be the most destructive, living force in the galaxy, and she decides to kill him.
Jason didn't answer. It troubled him that there was nothing in Lumia's words inconsistent with the Vergere he knew. Had Vergere been a student of the Force in that time period, which he knew she was, he was certain that she would have studied every facet of the Force she could find. And if she became certain that her teacher was a force for destruction, she would have tried to find some way to doom him.
But Vergere strikes too soon, Lumia continued. Palpatine survives and puts killers on her trail. She uses Jedi Order resources to keep her a step ahead of her pursuers, and soon accepts a Jedi mission that may get her clear of her enemies. It takes her to the world of Zonama Seacoat, and from there she chooses to leave with the mission that eventually reaches the galaxy of the Yuuzhan Vong.
That doesn't make her Sith, Jason said.
He kept his voice even, but he could feel the doubt growing within him. Lumia's words made so much sense, casting Vergere within a context that finally made her comprehensible to him. But only if Lumia's claims about the non-destructive, non-corruptive basis to the Sith were actually true. Lumia's tone turned chiding.
Think about it, Jason. She cared for you, cared for the fate of the galaxy, cared for everyone. She gave Mara Jade the healing treatment that allowed her to carry that boy. She was a Sith, and yet she helped give Luke Skywalker a son. She could be cruelly ruthless, couldn't she? And yet each act of ruthlessness improved matters, improved her surroundings, improved you.
Nalani gave Jason one more look, and in her glance there was worry and anguish.
That's it,
she said. She struck at Lumia.